It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the very important role that Iowa played in settling the question of slavery in the United States. Of course, we've known for a very long time that Iowa sent a lot of soldiers to fight in the Civil War, but the struggle over slavery predated the Civil War, and we're taking a look at that period this hour. I'm talking with historian Lowell Soike. He's the author of the new book, Busy in the Cause, Iowa, the Free State Struggle in the West, and the prelude to the Civil War. Doug Jones is also here. He's an archaeologist with the State Historical Society and has been the leader of the Iowa Freedom Trail Project. Coming up a little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about some of the new discoveries that Doug has made about the Underground Railroad, specifically in Clinton County. But right now, we're focusing on that period before the Civil War, particularly the stuff going on in Kansas after the territorial election of 1855. As we were talking about before the break, a lot of people came over from Missouri to vote in that election to make sure that there was a pro-slavery representative headed to Congress from the territory. But after that, there was still a lot of controversy over the validity of that election, right, Lowell?
Yes. From that point on, the group of folks that were elected to the legislature were all pro-slavery folks. They were dominated by that. But as a result, the Free State folks just sort of refused to vote in the elections. And they sort of, by late 1855, they were forming their own party and looking for their own way to statehood as a free state. But so it was a deep cleavage between them. And so.
All right. And Doug, maybe you can fill us in on some of the things going on in Iowa during this time. So all of that controversy is taking place in Kansas. But in Iowa, the settlers, the free staters who wanted to get to Kansas were having to travel through Iowa. So there's a route being built through the state of Iowa for these settlers who want to get there, right?
Yes. And actually, those efforts were largely they were largely developed by James Lane, who was very famous for his roles in the different activities in Kansas. And he was working with a number of people throughout the state of Iowa, and particularly William Penn Clark in Iowa City, who was the state chairman of the Iowa Kansas Free State Committee, where they were setting up routes to get people and supplies basically at the start from Iowa City down to Kansas. And eventually when the railroad lines came in, the route, the start of the route shifted down to Mount Pleasant. And it's been interesting going through and looking at some of the people that were part of the committee throughout the state. Some of these people we know quite well because they were actively involved with Underground Railroad activities and abolitionist activities. And yet some of these people, we still really don't know who they are.
And it's really difficult to find information on these people. Both of you have depended a lot on newspaper reports.
Correct.
But,
yes.
Of course, people didn't keep records of their Underground Railroad activities. They didn't necessarily want it to be known as free staters because it was a very dangerous thing to be, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes. And so many of the people that came through the runaways from their slave places in Missouri, they were left unknown to because they were just passing through and helped along the way, but then it would be forgotten. What was their names again, you know, kind of thing. And so we don't know hardly any of the names of all those that were helped.
Let's talk about some of the stories that you have uncovered about people who were helped, the freedom seekers who were trying to escape from slavery. And it is also interesting to note that while this debate was going on, the pro-slavery forces were worried about the future, saying that if this new territory became a free state, that all of these things would happen, that people would start helping their slaves escape, people would kidnap slaves. And these things did actually start coming to pass. I mean, the pro-slavery forces were absolutely right about
right.
What would happen, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Correct.
Yep. And so they were getting desperate by mid-1856 in western Missouri that this all would come to pass. And so they That's why they closed off the river to further settlement coming in from the other states that were not from of the South. And so it was because of closing off the river then and the steamboats couldn't come up the Missouri that they then decided to try going across Iowa, and all the caravans then moved across there in the summer of 1856 in order to offset that closure of the river by the pro-slavery folks.
And people were arming themselves. Iowa was also an important supply route for the coveted Sharps rifles.
Yes.
What made the Sharps rifles such an important linchpin in this
Well, it gave the Free State folks an edge by because most of the folks out in western Missouri and stuff, the slavery folks, just had shotguns and old muskets and rifles and stuff like that. And whereas the folks coming from the east were aware of the Sharps rifles that had been developed, which was a breech-loading rifle that could shoot rapidly and also was very accurate at long range. And so it became a way of intimidating the pro-slavery folks from taking a strong action against them. And so they were bringing in Sharps rifles, as many as they could, the Free State folks. And there was a lot of shipments that were made and some that were slavery folks were able to stop, but they still kept moving, and it gave an edge to the Free State folks.
And fiery abolitionist John Brown also played a role in this conflict. He and his sons did. He spent some time in Iowa and actually instigated a raid, right, Doug?
Actually, one of the last things that happened was that he and his party of men went into three farms in southwest Missouri to liberate slaves, and they wound up liberating some other things, too, in addition to the slaves. But there was a bit of controversy about this raid because during this raid, one of John Brown's men wound up killing one of the owners during the raid, and that particular instance really caused some issues on that final trip where they left Missouri, went into Kansas, spent some time in Kansas, headed into Nebraska, and then eventually went all the way through Iowa. And their reception at different places in Iowa really varied because of killing the owner during this raid. There were some people that were okay with that, and there were other people that were not. And there were particularly people at Taber, Iowa, were very concerned because they were already concerned about people from Missouri coming to Taber looking for runaway slaves, looking for different people that were involved with these activities. And there was always this constant threat of people coming up there and starting issues and problems within the town. And Taber really was the supply depot at that time for people and goods and supplies moving from Iowa down through Nebraska to Kansas. And so the people that were down fighting in Kansas would many times come up to Taber to get some rest, get medical supplies, get communications out, or if they were headed back east for whatever reasons, like John Brown made five or six trips through the state of Iowa, that was one of the entryways to get to the east was getting to Taber and then going through Iowa and heading east.
And we've talked about Taber on this program in the past, but for people who haven't heard those conversations, I mean, this was a really unusual community in Iowa. Taber and Civil Bend were two communities in the state of Iowa that were strongholds for anti-slavery.
Yes, they were largely Congregationalist settlers that had come there from Ohio, and they had come in the early 1850s, and then they were all at Civil Bend, and then a group of them, because of the flood of 1851, moved up to higher ground and created Taber. And so that was a small community when this when this 1856 movement across the Free State folks to Kansas happened, and so it was a stopping off point before they entered Nebraska on their way to Kansas, and so that's where they would rest up, and the Free State folks would be able to get ready and get their supplies and heal their sick and all that before they went on.
Right. And it should also be said, many of these people actually came from Oberlin, Ohio, and many of these people had known John Brown and his family and many of these people for quite a while. So these were not strangers out here in the prairies of Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, and Iowa. A lot of these people had known each other for quite a while, and which is something that often gets lost in some of the previous histories that have been written about these activities.
On that trek to with 12 slaves that John Brown took up from Missouri to Iowa, that was in December 1858 and early 1859 when that was happening. And the problem that Tabor folks had with John Brown at that time is that they always helped people that would escape to Iowa, but they were firmly against going down and into slave states and rescuing folks and bringing them into Iowa. And so that was why they were very frustrated with John Brown having captured slaves in a slave state and brought them up to Tabor where they thought they'd be in danger.
Presumably, they were concerned that would start. I mean, there were already violent conflicts taking place in Kansas and in Missouri and in Iowa.
Yes.
But they were afraid that would start a full-scale war. And that's what John Brown seemed to want.
Yes. And Tabor folks and Civil Bend folks were all very concerned that because of their close proximity, be exposed to the slave state just a few miles away. You know?
It was interesting in reading your book, Lowell, that as people were traveling west, really the rhetoric about slavery got more and more heated, because in the East, where there were so many people who owned slaves, living so close to people who did not own slaves, and there was so much debate over the subject. In churches, even if the pastor was anti-slavery, they wouldn't necessarily preach about that or include that because they were afraid that they would alienate some of their parishioners. But the new churches out west weren't concerned about that.
Yes, and it's because they were forming at the time when the times were changing and attitudes toward slavery. After that Nebraska-Kansas Act that opened up the territories, that the ideas, acceptance of anti-slavery ideas was growing, and with the West being settled at that very same time, the Western churches, at least the Congregationalists and Baptists and those folks, Wesleyan Methodists, they were more radicalized than were those of their homes back east.
Let's talk about an individual freedom seeker, because you write these stories in the book, Lowell, and mm-hmm. Doug, you're welcome to jump in here as well. You write about Judy Clark. She was a woman who was trying to get to freedom, and there's a tiny detail in her story that I think is so interesting, and that is when she is trying to get to freedom and she's traveling and she needs help, she sees a man who is traveling in a wagon and he's reading a book. And so she assumes that if this man is reading a book, he must be a free stater, and she can ask him for help. I thought that was such an interesting detail.
Yes, I found that the same, that would be a telltale sign. You used to also hear about it being, you could tell if they were a free stater if they had a copy of the New York Tribune in their back pocket, because another sign that was a friend.
But that's such an incredibly dangerous situation, because here she is in this area where there are so many pro-slavery settlers and she needs assistance. And that must have been an incredibly frightening time for anyone who was trying to get to freedom to try to figure out who was a friend and who was not. How did they know other than a book or, or a newspaper?
It was really a lot of luck and just trusting that you could sort of sense who would be a friend and not.
And many times the people made the journey, you know, their journey to freedom on their own. They didn't want help, and they purposely avoided people. But in other cases, you know, people did find help. And there were people, and particularly we just recently found a story about one Henry Baker, who was held as a slave in Nottoway County, Missouri. We don't exactly know how he wound up getting up to Clarinda, Iowa, as a freedom seeker. But then he turns around and actually becomes an Underground Railroad agent and is going back down into Nottoway County. Talk about extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. Going down in back to his area where he was held as a slave and rescuing family members and friends and bringing them up to College Springs, Iowa, and Clarinda, Iowa, down in Page County. Amazing stories.
Well, and I can imagine you write, Lowell, about a couple of other people who wanted to go back into the territory that they came from to try to rescue family and friends, that freedom seekers had to leave so many people that they loved behind. Is that a common story, Doug, that they would go back and try to rescue people they cared about?
Yeah, it actually turns out that was a fairly common thing that many of the freedom seekers wanted to do. And actually, one of the places that just got listed on the Network to Freedom, the Wittenberg Rural Community, there were a whole series of freedom seekers that wind up showing up at just north of Newton in Jasper County in the Wittenberg Rural Community. And many of them actually joined Company E of the 60th Iowa, which was the first colored infantry unit from Iowa. And they, even during the Civil War and after the Civil War, many of them who stayed in the community wound up reuniting their families back, and many of them wound up in Newton. Some of them actually wound up moving back to Nottoway County, Missouri, where they were held as slaves.
Wow.
And Judy Clark that we were speaking of, when she was helped by John Armstrong up to Tabor, she she then would write letters to John Armstrong offering him money, $500 for if he could go and rescue her other children.
Oh.
And so
heartbreaking. Yeah. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with historian Lowell Soike. He's the author of the new book, Busy in the Cause, Iowa, the Free State Struggle in the West and the Prelude to the Civil War. Doug Jones is also here. He's an archaeologist with the State Historical Society and has been the leader of the Iowa Freedom Trail Project and has made many important discoveries about the Underground Railroad in Iowa. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join with your questions and your stories. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the role that Iowa played in settling the question of slavery, or trying to settle the question of slavery, in the period leading up to the Civil War. Historian Lowell Soike is here. He's author of the new book, Busy in the Cause, Iowa, the Free State Struggle in the West and the Prelude to the Civil War. Doug Jones is also here. He's an archaeologist with the State Historical Society. And they'll both be part of a book release party that's also part of the Wonder of Words Festival in Des Moines, coming up next Thursday at the State Historical Building, starting at 4:30 in the afternoon. And before the break, we were talking about some of these individual freedom seekers and the route that they took to freedom, where they found shelter, their desire to go back and free the people that they left behind. One of the places in Iowa where freedom seekers could find shelter was also in Grinnell. And Doug, you were talking about people settling in Iowa after they escaped from slavery. And settling in Iowa was a really dangerous thing to do because we were so close to a slave state, right?
Yes. And there were actually, you know, there were known places that were heavily involved with Underground Railroad activities, and the bounty hunters and different people that were searching for runaway slaves or freedom seekers knew those places quite well, and staying in those places would be a bit hairy at times when those people decided to strike while the iron was hot and try to get the freedom seekers contained and taken back to Missouri or wherever they were being held as slaves. Particularly at Grinnell, there was one issue. There was a race riot, is what it's been referred to as. There was an incident where some of the local abolitionists and anti-slavery people wanted four adult men, freedom seekers, to attend the school. And there was basically an armed standoff at the school with people who were opposed to letting those four individuals attend the school. And what eventually happened, it's a longer story, and one of our colleagues, David Conan, has written several stories about this. Basically, what happens is the freedom seekers that were attending the school wound up leaving, and the four men were not allowed to attend school, and everybody was basically hustled out of the community eventually. And some of the school activities for freedom seekers actually switched from the school to a private residence. And the private residence they were already known abolitionists, and so there was still a lot of speculation about what was going on at that. But the school activities changed to the private residence.
And was this the incident as well that wound up being in the newspapers down in Missouri?
Yes, there was a lot of coverage about that particular set of incidences all over throughout the state of Iowa, down in Missouri.
And getting that event covered in the newspaper down in St. Louis, that's sort of an invitation to people to come on up and find some escaped slaves, right?
Absolutely.
So, such an incredibly dangerous time. Lowell?
Yeah. And this was gradually fading by the 1859, 1860, though, because times, the feelings had changed so much that the fugitive slave hunters were not so much coming up into Iowa, but they were focusing more on the opportunities to kidnap blacks in Iowa and try to get them back for sale because the prices of slaves were so high in the late 1850s. And so that was where the incentives were rather than trying to get your slaves back by going up into the state where you found less and less support and help doing that.
So they were actually kidnapping free blacks and selling them into slavery.
Yes. Yes.
And that there are incidents where that you documented that happening in Iowa.
Yes.
Yeah, including Milton Howard, who's one of the freedom seekers that's buried at Oakdale Cemetery in Davenport, and which was the other place that just got listed on the National Park Service Network to Freedom. And that's exactly what happened to Milton Howard. His whole family they were a free black family living, I believe, in Muscatine, and they were kidnapped and sold back into slavery, and Milton eventually escaped via the Underground Railroad, got back to Iowa, enlisted in the 60th Iowa, went and fought in the Civil War, and then went on to do a lot of important things after that and became a community leader within the Davenport area.
There was a time when we really didn't know very much about the Underground Railroad activity in Iowa. There were a lot of rumors, but just not a lot of documentation. And the two of you have done an incredible amount of research to uncover these stories and to share these stories. Doug, was there a sort of watershed moment where you figured out how to uncover these stories?
Well, let me clarify this. Lowell and myself and John Zeller and Eric Lana, who've all worked on this project throughout the years, I'm actually the last person in the organization that's still working on the project. Everybody else has retired or has no longer involved with the State Historical Society. But we're doing a lot of this research in true Underground Railroad fashion with a lot of help from our friends. And so we actually have people looking for things continuously, and not just here in Iowa, but as far as Oregon and California and now even the East Coast. And one of the things that one of my volunteers, David Holmgren, who's been volunteering for a long, long time, one of the things that really came into focus with the project was we had collected all this information about Underground Railroad activities in Iowa. But when you started looking at that, you really didn't know who these people were. So we're now going back and doing a lot more research on who these people were, filling out biographical forms, and we're finding out a lot more information about some of these people, and some of this information is really essential for understanding what was going on.
Now, you have recently made new discoveries about Underground Railroad activity in Clinton County. Can you tell me what you found?
Well, and once again, actually, I was out of the office when my volunteer, David Holmgren, stumbled into some very important things about one Cornelius Bowman Campbell, who resided in Clinton. But he got there in 1855, along with his wife, Phoebe, and they were actually agents with the American Anti-Slavery Society and also associated with the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. And they basically specifically came out there to not only agitate within the local area to promote abolition activities and events, but they were actively starting Underground Railroad activities. And this is pretty well known in the local histories. Clinton County has had a pretty well-documented history of Underground Railroad activities. But the one curious thing about Clinton County, they never gave first names of people. It was always, like in Campbell's case, C.B. Campbell, and you really didn't know who they were. We did know from these early histories that Cornelius Campbell, as we now know, one of the secret coded messages that has been famous from Iowa was actually from George Weston in Lilmore, Iowa, also in Clinton County, to C.B. Campbell in Clinton County. Well, David Holmgren has found is that George Weston was actually a relative of C.B. Campbell's and also came out about the same time as the Campbells, and he was actively involved with Underground Railroad activities. C.B. Campbell was also tied in with a lot of the prominently known national abolitionists of the time, Lewis Tappan, Susan B. Anthony. We've got a record of him donating $2 to Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton for women's suffrage cause back in 1855-56. There are letters now that we've found from C.B. Campbell off to different members of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. So far, we haven't seen anything that sheds more light about specific Underground Railroad stories in Iowa. But we're now starting to see a lot more involvement that we had not really previously seen here in Iowa, where you actually have the American Anti-Slavery Society with a foothold in Iowa with multiple parties not only openly agitating, busy in the cause, so to speak, but also actually, you know, doing Underground Railroad activities and bringing out nationally known speakers like the Reverend Andrew Twombly Foss from Massachusetts to do anti-slavery speeches in Clinton County and also Cedar County.
Wow. And what was – you mentioned this famous coded message. What was it?
Well, hang on here. I can read that. Hang on. Let me look at my notes because I can't remember it verbatim. But the message went – and it was dated May 6, 1859, from Lilmore. Mr. CBC, didn't even say Campbell, just Mr. CBC. Dear sir, by tomorrow evening's mail, you will receive 2 volumes of The Irrepressible Conflict, bound in black. After perusal, please forward an oblige. Yours truly, GWW. And that would be George Weston. We also just found out, too, that we did not know before last week that George Weston was related to Cornelius Campbell. It turns out George Weston went and fought in the Civil War and actually died shortly after the Civil War or maybe even during the Civil War from injuries. And his wife also died, leaving 2 sons. And the Campbells, who had actually moved out to New Jersey in 1863, came back and basically adopted the Weston boys and brought them back to New Jersey with them. So we're finding out a lot more information about these people and the depths of their involvement. And some of the involvement doesn't just mean here in Iowa. It's even at the national level.
Can you tell me what opened up this window of information? How did we figure out that CBC was Cornelius Campbell?
Well, through a lot of looking through Ancestry.com and historical records, and now that we know that they wound up in Vineland, New Jersey, it turns out Cornelius Campbell became an officer of the Historical Society out there, and so there's actually now we've actually found a three-part series about Cornelius Campbell and his family, and it turns out Cornelius Campbell, after the Civil War, continued working with Susan B. Anthony and various other parties on women's suffrage issues.
And now that you have a name, can you actually go to the Campbell's home and look for artifacts? Is there a possibility of that as well?
Well, the home here in Clinton is actually gone. Mm. It was demolished a long time ago. So, unfortunately, that's the sad story of the Underground Railroad history in Iowa. Most of these places are gone. They're archaeology sites at this point. And apparently the church that Cornelius Campbell was a congregational minister at one point, and that church still is up, and there are some records of when he served as the minister for that congregation. But and we're not really sure what's left out at Vineland, New Jersey yet.
Well, that's exciting. And it's so you were talking about researching the ancestry and the genealogy of a family. With the Freedom Seekers, you do not have that kind of luxury. And Lowell, you were writing about some of the individual Freedom Seekers in your book and explaining the names that they took. And there was one man was named My George and the other man was named Our George. And so that kind of information is just entirely lacking from that side of the story, isn't it?
Yes, it's so much lacking. My George, and that's just it happened to be in a letter that was going back from one of the people that was escorting the slaves there, and so he mentioned what was going on with what had happened with these people since our trip ended to Iowa, and so that's how we learned of some of these names, and that's so often the case. You just learn about them inadvertently through just being mentioned and giving you a little clue to check on later and try to build on.
And Charity, you know, one of the things we have so few good information about Freedom Seekers, period. There's I think we came to the conclusion about 20 people that we really have a lot of good information about. You know, where they came from, who they were held as slaves by, but I think that's going to change as we start looking a little bit more closely. I think there may be some information available that we can actually start looking at more of the Freedom Seekers and getting some more information about them.
You think there are still more opportunities to discover? I mean, I've been so impressed with the amount of stories, Lowell, that you've been able to compile, given how little information was left behind. But you both believe that there's more?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. And mostly through family records as families learn about, oh, you had gathered some stuff about us. Oh, yeah, we know somebody who has a diary that's still in the family, you know, that kind of stuff. You know.
So should Iowans be looking for those things?
Absolutely.
And you know, we hear so many stories about the Underground Railroad. This barn was part of it. That, you know, the kind of thing that in many cases is not true.
Yes.
But it's the letters, it's the diaries that really give you the clues that you need, not the actual places as much.
Yeah, it's funny. It's too bad that Iowa was in its first generation of buildings and structures when all this was happening. And so as the second generation of better buildings and stuff came on, the log cabins and the sod huts, all that stuff went their way. And so it's just the next generation of children who we have the buildings
of. Well, some of the stories remain. Lowell Soyke, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
Historian Lowell Soyke is the author of the new book, Busy in the Cause, Iowa, the Free State Struggle in the West and the Prelude to the Civil War. Doug Jones, thank you.
Thank you.
And keep us posted as you find new things.
I will.
Doug Jones is an archaeologist with the State Historical Society. They'll both be part of a book release party coming up next Thursday at 4:30 at the State Historical Building in Des Moines, part of the Wonder of Words Festival. I will be there as well. And with me now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. What's coming up at noon on the show today, Ben?
Today at noon, we're going to be asking the question, how are we doing in the fight against cancer? Cancer-related deaths continue to decline, but we're going to look at if funding is in jeopardy, if it puts our fight against cancer in jeopardy. Dr. George Wiener will be with us. He's director of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Other guests as well, Charity.
All right. Ben Kiefer, thank you very much. River to River coming up today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.